What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Luke Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I am your host, Charlie Robinson. How the hell are you? If you want to connect with the show, you can do so through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. There's a message feature there. If you like the book, you can buy it there, the digital version. Just donate $10 or more on PayPal, and I will send you an EPUB version for your e-reader and also a PDF, and you can share them with your friends and family. If you like the paperback, you can get it at Amazon from that dirty bastard that likes to take pictures of his dick and send it to people, Jeff Bezos, or you can get it at barnesandnoble.com. And I don't know who their CEO is, but something tells me he probably takes pictures of his nuts as well. Well, I'm telling you right now that this is going to be one of my favorite episodes because it's a topic that I love. I just love the concept. I love the everything that surrounds the idea of psychedelics. I love it. I'm not going to even lie to you. It's so fascinating. The things that you can discover by eating a bag of mushrooms or drinking ayahuasca or something along those lines. So I'll just sort of give you my personal experience and my personal opinions on these sorts of things. The United States has, I think everyone is aware of this, has really destroyed itself with the drug war. And there's a tendency to label everything as drugs. Oh, you can't do drugs. Drugs are bad for you. Drugs will kill you. You know, this is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions? You know, all of this stuff, the war on drugs. Everything about it is bullshit. Having a government to decide what you can and can't put in your body is insulting, frankly. Now, it's not to say that, you should do every sort of drug out there because some are more damaging than others. But the labeling, the classification of everything as drugs and drugs are bad for you. Well, right there, I mean, just thinking about that statement is it exposes itself as being hypocritical because when you go to the hospital, what do they give you sometimes? They give you drugs. So are drugs bad? Well, it depends. Well, what's the distinction? Where's that line in the sand that you cross between a drug that's good for you and a drug that's bad for you? Well, people would say, well, you know, drugs that you get addicted to are bad for you and drugs that you don't get addicted to. No, because there's plenty of drugs that are legal through prescription that you can get really screwed up on. Hydrocodone, OxyContin, you know, there's prescription medications are killing people at an alarming rate. So just because a doctor prescribes it doesn't make it good or bad. And just because a doctor doesn't prescribe it doesn't by definition make it a bad thing. You know, there's plenty of drugs out there that can be abused. And, you know, if they legalized all drugs, like they've done in Portugal, I think that you would have a much different outcome as far as the way we view addiction and the way we incarcerate people for drug offenses. You know, the United States is just totally fucked. I mean, it's so backwards when it comes to drugs. I mean, nothing just epitomizes the hypocrisy of the American government than their relationship with drugs. You know, if the FDA legalizes it and can make money off of it, then it's fine. Regardless of how many people it kills, right? They just say, oh, it's fine. You know, think of all the prescription, all big pharma, all the drug recalls that they've had that have hurt people, have killed people. When people say this drug has been ruled, you know, has been approved by the FDA, therefore that equals it's safe, it's not. It's really not. And consequentially, if it's a drug that has not been approved by the FDA, it doesn't automatically mean that it's dangerous. It just means it hasn't jumped through the hoops necessary to get approval in the United States of America. So, you know, when it comes to what they would describe as recreational drugs, there's massive hypocrisy there too, in terms of the schedule of drugs. Like, what's a Schedule One drug? You know, mean it has no medicinal value. You know, you can't have it both ways. You can't have marijuana have no medicinal value and then simultaneously have it legalized for medical use. You know, I mean, it's preposterous. It's contradictory, you know, not to mention the fact that marijuana has been legalized for recreational use in plenty of states, including the state where I live, Colorado. Don't think I haven't taken them up on that, because I have. You know, it's great to be able to go down to a store and walk in and buy what you want, as opposed to having to buy it from some sketchy dude who runs up to your car when you pull into the gas station on the corner of Pico and Alvarado, like we did in college, you know? Yo, what you need? I mean, so for us to pretend that, you know, recreational drugs are all bad and that pharmaceutical drugs are all good is insanity. And I think people are waking up to that. I think that with the opioid epidemic that has been underway in the United States over the last 15 years, well, ever since we secured the poppy fields in Afghanistan, you know, it's all flooded into the United States and screwed everybody up. And I would say that was not accidental. I don't know. Maybe it was coincidental, but I don't think so. I think there was a plan in place, but that's just my little conspiratorial mind. But the first time I ever did a psychedelic was my freshman year in college. And I'll tell you what, it had a profound effect on me in a very good way. I had never given it much thought as to sort of the nature of reality and what that entails and, you know, what are we doing? It's not to say I didn't think about, like, why are we here and what happens when you die. I think everybody goes through that. But reality had always been very inflexible to me. You know, you wake up in the morning, you get out of bed, and everything you see is your world, and everything that you don't see doesn't impact you in this world that you're living in. And then when you do mushrooms, then what you come to understand is that there is a world beyond what you can physically see or hear. You know, the first time you start to feel the effects of mushrooms kicking in, you get this, I always had, like, there, I had a Bob Marley poster on my wall. What a surprise. But it was kind of a cartoonish Bob Marley put. Well, it wasn't really. I mean, it had a little graphic design work to it. So it wasn't a photographic exactly. But the first time I ever felt mushrooms kick in was staring at that picture and seeing that it was just like a subtle head movement left and right. And those dreadlocks were just kind of shaking just a little bit. And you go, okay, all right, this is different. And then you progress into being able to hear things differently and see things differently. I always had this, it always made me throw up too, by the way. Maybe more information than you wanted, but you know, just it upsets your stomach when you're eating like poisonous mushrooms or whatever, however you want to classify them. And I always got the feeling I would come out of the bathroom and I would say to my friends, somebody just paint this bathroom, because it looked like it just had a fresh coat of paint on it. So it screws up your vision a little bit. And but it would improve my hearing to a point where like I could hear people having conversations in other rooms that normally you wouldn't hear. So anyway, it monkeyed with your senses a lot. And I had always thought of my senses as being set in stone. You know, this is what I can see. This is what I can hear. This is what I can, you know, process. And what I realized was that when you would take these substances, it allowed those levels to be like, if you think of your senses as being like an equalizer, like, you know, like something on a computer screen or something where you can manipulate the range of frequencies. What I realized was that my senses could be moved up and down too. So I could hear things I couldn't hear before. But I wasn't, you know, I was lower in some categories, but higher in others. And they were senses that I just had assumed were always inflexible. And so I found that to be interesting. And, you know, the first time I did mushrooms, we listened to the Pink Floyd Wish You Were Here album, which is, there's only five songs, you know, but it starts and ends with the same song. And, you know, you listen to that in a darkened room, and the first time you've ever done mushrooms, and you just realize like, oh my God, there is so much more going on, in this world, in this, you know, reality than what we experience on a daily basis. And when I later, came across this Bill Hicks quote that I thought was appropriate considering, you know, I'm listening to a Pink Floyd album for my first time doing mushrooms. And it says, if you don't think drugs have done good things for us, then take all your records, tapes, and CDs and burn them. Because you know what? The musicians that made all that great music that enhanced your life throughout the years were really fucking high on drugs. The Beatles were so fucking high, they let Ringo sing a few tunes. So it occurred to me that while I was listening to that, I was like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure that Roger Waters and David Gilmour, you know, have an idea of where I am in my mind right now. I'm not saying that they necessarily were on mushrooms when they wrote their albums, but I'm just saying that music and the feeling, you know, how layered it is, the synthetic, you know, synthesizers and all these interesting, you know, I mean, that is an album that is made for mushrooms. I just have to be honest with everybody. It takes you to a different place. It kind of lifts you up and you go through this progression and then it brings you down. Like when it starts with the same song and ends with the same song and you're just like, oh my God, I totally remember. You know, when you get to the second portion of the song, you're like, I totally remember that. Oh my God. I feel like I've been on like a trip somewhere. You know, I've gone up, I've come down. And so to me, that was one of the first things I realized through my first time using psychedelics was that if you are trying to make sense of the world, of your reality, you have to acknowledge that there is a world beyond your eyes, that if you're just measuring this world as being what you can see or hear or smell or taste, you're limiting yourself a great deal, because there's frequencies that we can't hear as humans, but it doesn't make them any less real. It's just that we're not able to pick up on them. There's colors that our eyes can't process. And there's a lot more going on out there. you know, they talk about a sixth sense and everything. What's our sixth sense or intuition? All that stuff gets heightened on these substances. And, you wind up connecting with things, or you wind up having you wind up feeling like there is another universe out there. The idea that we're, you know, that there's multiple universes out there sounds crazy when you're sober. When you're on a decent amount of ayahuasca, you're like, multiple universes? I mean, not only does it seem possible, but it seems likely. You know, it seems like, well, look, I don't know how this universe is all, you know, stitched together. But the version that we get on a day-to-day basis is just one version of it, that there is more to it. And for someone that's never gone down this path and has never done psychedelics, this may sound, well, it will sound stupid. It'll sound impossible and it won't make any sense. I mean, you may believe me. You may say, well, I have no reason to think that he's not telling me the truth, but you'll never really understand it until you experience it. It's kind of like when people are like, oh, once you have kids, then you'll understand. And then you come to that point where you're about to have kids and you're like, I hear you. I know what you're saying. I acknowledge that things will be different. But then once it happens and you have kids, you're like, oh, okay, now I understand what you're talking about. I always knew. I didn't think you were wrong. I figured you were correct when you said things will change and things will be different. And I believed you when you said it's hard for me to understand that without experiencing it myself, you know. But then once you have kids, you're like, now I understand what you guys are all talking about. It's kind of like that with psychedelics. You can paint the picture. You can listen to Joe Rogan talk about DMT. You can do all of those things. And you can have an understanding to a certain extent. I believe you. I know that you're not lying to me about those things. So I believe that what you're saying is true. However, without you experiencing it firsthand, you can't ever really know. You can have an idea and you can sort of know what to expect, but you can't really know. You have to go through that process. And I suggest it for people, not everybody, of course. I mean, I think for people that are like sober and like had addiction issues, to let your guard down and go down that path, you know, to take a substance and go down that path when you already know you have addiction issues, could be problematic. Not because I think that somebody would get addicted to mushrooms or DMT or anything like that, because it doesn't really work that way. But just if you're somebody that has always struggled with wanting to let go of your current reality, then it could potentially open you up to, you know, to a relapse into that. Because what you'd get it through psychedelic experiences is you get sort of an escape from reality for a while. And a lot of people seek that out if they have, you know, if they have like a, you know, rough childhood, they've had some sort of trauma and abuse, then they start to want to escape from that reality. And a lot of times they go towards, you know, alcohol and cocaine and heroin and all these things, and meth and things like that. And obviously I find those to be really destructive drugs. But they're using those drugs to escape reality. And when you're talking about something like ayahuasca or mushrooms or DMT, you're also escaping reality. It might be for different reasons, but I think that just to be on the safe side, I think people with addiction issues should just be careful. That being said, I think that psychedelics have a healing property to them. In fact, I know they have a healing property to them. And that could theoretically help people with addiction. I know Iboga, or Ibogaine is used to treat opioid addiction. And apparently it works really well. I've never done it. I don't know. I don't have an opioid addiction either, so I wouldn't be the right person to talk about. But there have been studies done that show that mushrooms, where they've done like CT scans on people's brains, and they and they do it before and after. And what they've determined was that before doing mushrooms, there were fewer connections, and after doing mushroom sessions, the connections between the neurons in the brain increased. It reconnected these neural pathways, which is something that's way beyond my understanding of it. But I'm just talking about something that I've read about this work having tremendous benefits. So there's some interesting, you know, psychological benefits to it, but also there might be physical benefits to it as well, in terms of the brain sort of reconstructing itself and reattaching these pathways that had been disconnected a long time ago. And I didn't know that doing mushrooms, you know, in college or anything, I didn't know that or do it for those reasons. But what I did feel was that I had a much broader perspective of the world afterwards. I was, I hate that term, you know, thinking outside of the box. But if you use that analogy and you think of us as being in a box, one of the things that mushrooms or acid and I'm not a huge fan of acid, but only because it's synthetic and not man-made, but things like peyote and ayahuasca and DMT and mushrooms and the like, what they do is they most definitely take you outside of that box and allow you to sort of play around in a area of reality that is off limits to us on a normal day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis. And so they call it a trip because you go there and you come back like you do on a vacation. So it's an appropriate name for it. And I found it really helpful to me because I saw the world one way, and after being introduced to hallucinogens, I saw the world, I was able to see it not just the way that I saw it before, but I was also able to incorporate some other aspects into the way I viewed things. And that was that, first of all, it's extremely humbling. You know, you want to feel insignificant, but not in a bad way, but just it. One of the key things that they talk about with DMT and all these hallucinogens is it's an overriding theme is ego disillusion, where your ego that is driving you constantly gets put off to the side for a little while, and you're able to see the world in a different way without your consciousness, without your ego driving the boat, instead of, you know, you're just your overall consciousness. And so it's a humbling experience because you realize, okay, I'm not the center of the universe, obviously. There are more important things going on here than my little problems or my little successes or whatever, you know, whatever you think is, if you think you're hot shit, these things have a tendency to sort of take you down, a few pegs. If you have low self-esteem, it works to kind of raise you up a couple pegs as well, because what it reminds you is that, hey, listen, you know, you've got things that are going wrong in your life, but, we're all in this together. You're part of this amazing universe that is very difficult to understand how it all works. You're not alone. We're all connected. So it depends on who you are going into these events. And people have said, if you remember Empire Strikes Back, I am a Star Wars geek, but if you remember Empire Strikes Back, when Luke is training with Yoda and he's about to go into the cave and he looks back at Yoda and he says, "What's in there?" And Yoda says, "Only what you take with you." And that's kind of how I've felt about hallucinogenic experiences. It's like, well, what are you going to see? What's going to happen? You know, well, that depends on what you bring in there with you. Are you bringing a lot of trauma? Then you may have experiences of that. You may have to relive some of that. You may have to process and deal with some of that. You'd probably be better for it in the end. Probably come out feeling like you've dealt with it a little bit more. Maybe the reason why you've got some problems in your life is you've been suppressing this trauma, and it really needs to come out so that you'll feel better. And and hallucinogens kind of force you to deal with some things. It's sort of like a like the Elvis Costello song, Deep Dark Truthful Mirror, you know, it kind of puts that right in front of you. So you can't really escape it. You kind of have to deal with it. Now, they're all a little different. I've experienced ayahuasca and peyote and 5-MeO-DMT I've done all those in ceremonies with shaman. So it's different from like doing mushrooms with your buddy at a Grateful Dead concert, or, you know, or doing acid with your friends and wandering around campus and like, hey, let's go get into some adventures. I mean, those are all like interesting things, but not the same as having a situation with a shaman. So they talk about set and setting as being important. Yeah, it's important. First time you do mushrooms, don't do it at a big party with a bunch of people in an environment that's uncontrollable. Lock yourself in your house, turn off your cell phones. I didn't have cell phones to worry about back in college, but I would even go so far, after a little bit of experience, I would tape up newspapers over the mirror in the bathroom because after you get stuck in a mirror for 45 minutes and come out and your friends are like, hey man, where you been? You're like, dude, I was like looking at myself in the mirror for the last 45 minutes. You can do that, and it's certainly an interesting trip, but with a little bit of experience, I got to the point where I was like, listen, I don't need to do that anymore. I'm just going to tape these newspapers up over it. So, you know, the set and setting is good. You got to be someplace safe. You got to feel protected. You got to be able to lock the door, close the blinds, turn your phones off, get some good music going, have everything that you need so you don't have to venture out into the zombie apocalypse of interacting with people. I remember having to go to like this convenience store that was right the first time we ever did mushrooms. It was me and two other guys, and we just got done with our Pink Floyd session, and we were like, all right, we're going to go to the little liquor store right across the way from us, and we're going to walk in there. And before we went in, we're like, okay, we're going to keep it together. We're going to walk in. We're going to act normal, right? Right. Okay. We're all in agreement. As soon as we open that door and those bright lights hit us, we just came unglued. I couldn't stop laughing. All of us couldn't stop. We looked like a bunch of maniacs in there fumbling around, trying to buy Cheetos and Marlboro lights and everything. I mean, it's just a mess. So get yourself in a situation where, you know, you don't have to deal with people that are not on your same wavelength. I've got stories, man. I've got some stories of some crazy, crazy experiences. Maybe I'll get into some of them, but I probably won't tell you all the juicy ones. I'll save those for later. When I talk about the experience of feeling like we're limiting ourselves or we're shortchanging ourselves by just assuming that everything that we can see with our five senses is the extent of reality. I came across this quote and I put it in my book because I really connected with it. And it's by a guy named David Wong, who's an author. And he said this, he was talking about, psychedelics and everything. He was talking about the way our bodies are configured. Anyway, it goes like this. The human eye has to be one of the cruelest tricks nature ever pulled. We can see a tiny cone-shaped area of light right in front of our faces, restricted to a very narrow band of the electromagnetic spectrum. We can't see around walls. We can't see heat or cold. We can't see electricity or radio signals. We can't see at a distance. It is a sense so limited that we might as well not have it. Yet we have evolved to depend so heavily on it as a species that all other perception has atrophied. We have wound up with this utterly mad and awful, often fatal delusion that if we can't see something, it doesn't exist. Virtually all of civilization's failures can be traced back to that one ominous sentence, I'll believe it when I see it. So whether or not you believe that those other dimensions exist is largely irrelevant. They're there. You have the ability to cross over and see things from a perspective that will shatter your illusion of reality. And some people fear this. But you know, don't worry. You can always go back to knowing everything tomorrow. You know, John Lennon said, the more I see, the less I know for sure. So, you know, I'm a fan of comedians that see the world differently. I'm a fan of Bill Hicks, George Carlin, Joe Rogan, all these guys. They all have something in common. They all have had massive experimentation with psychedelics, and they have all come to the conclusion that I have too, which is that, you know, there's a lesson to be learned there. There's value there. There's entertainment there too. Let's be honest. I mean, some of it is fun, but it's also educational. And so you've got Bill Hicks saying, today a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. There's no such thing as death. Life is only a dream, and we are the imagination of ourselves. Here's Tom with the weather. So classic Bill Hicks there. And as quotable as Bill Hicks is, there is nobody that is more interesting to quote than Terrence McKenna. And if you're unfamiliar with who Terrence McKenna is, well, go look him up, because you kind of have to see the picture. You know, crazy frizzy hair and little glasses, and he talks like this, you know, very scientifically and very, you know, and he makes up these crazy words, and he tells the nuttiest stories about psychedelics and all the things. But he is an ethnobotanist, and he was a scientist, and he lived in Hawaii and conducted all these crazy experiments. And his brother Dennis McKenna is still alive and is still, you'll see him from time to time on Joe Rogan. But I must have put half a dozen quotes from Terrence in here. In fact, I named the chapter in my book Death by Astonishment, and I'll get to that in a second as to, for the quote that came from. But one of the things that he said is, part of what psychedelics do is they decondition you from cultural values. This is what makes it such a political hot potato. Since all culture is kind of a con game, the most dangerous candy you can hand out is the one which causes people to start questioning the rules of the game. And I would suggest that Terrence is correct in this, and that part of the reason why psychedelics are illegal is because, not because they're worried about you, but because the people that are in control of this current paradigm know that it will allow you to, knows it will cause you to see things differently. You see the world differently, see that their rules are bullshit, that the laws that they've constructed are arbitrary and created by man, and that we've decided to allow one group of people to rule over the rest of us. And if you do psychedelics, one of the things that becomes painfully obvious is that the world that you are living in is totally fucking crazy and backwards, and they don't want you to know that. So it takes me to a follow-up Terrence McKenna quote, and that is, psychedelics are illegal not because a loving government is concerned that you may jump out of a third-story window. Psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally laid-down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong. Ding, ding, ding. That's it. That's it right there. And I would follow up on that and say that they also open you up to the fact that everything that you believe is right in this world is not actually right. And that following laws, because some group of people decided they wrote it in a book and now it, and then they all asked, you know, raised their hands and voted for it, that we have to follow those instructions is insanity. You know, if there are unjust laws, the fact that we follow them because we're threatened by being put in a cage if we don't. People that do psychedelics don't think like people that run for government. That's kind of a distinction between, you know, you should. Oh God, I think I put it in here. I have to look for the quote, but one of the quotes was like, I think that It was Graham Hancock said, I think that every politician before running for office should be forced to do ayahuasca 10 times. Absolutely correct. Because if you do that, if you go down that path, if you examine yourself that in that way, in a way that frankly only psychedelics can allow you to do, just this honest assessment of yourself, you will not, first of all, you probably won't be inclined to want to become a politician, because people that want to become politicians typically are the people that like to tell everyone else what to do. And the thing about psychedelics, I mean, yeah, you get some of these people that are kind of like cult leader types that'll tell you, you know, they'll go off on this kind of God complex and, you know, like Jim Jones and these guys, and that'll tell you, you know, want to tell you how to act and behave and everything, and under the guise of peace, love, and happiness, and we're all hippies living in our hippie commune. But for the most part, people that do psychedelics, they don't want to become world leaders that are enslaving people and upholding this tyrannical control structure that we've erected around us as a society. You just can't be somebody that's into mushrooms and into that at the same time. They don't work together, and that's something that you will that's a good byproduct of hallucinogens, because it will allow you to see the world in a way that doesn't put you at the center of the universe, which is helpful, because the people that are in high positions of government are narcissistic psychopaths. And one of the things that's a characteristic trademark of all of them is the fact that they think that they're the center of the universe, and that they think that what they're saying is going to work. You know, is it like, I'm going to tell you how to do it, because we're going to do it my way, because my way is right. And the thing about these hallucinogenic substances is that when you get that ego dissolving away, you start to realize that you're in no position to tell anyone what to do about things. Certainly not to line them up and put them in cages for things. It just doesn't occur to you that that's a way to operate. So it is most definitely in the system's best interest to keep substances, hallucinogenic substances, illegal, because they do not want you to understand that you have more power than you think, that you are an infinite being, that you are something more than just some tax slave living on a plantation, working for some government somewhere. You know, look, it's not just hippies like Terrence that are talking about the benefits of this. You guys, here's a quote from Steve Jobs, you know, co-founder of Apple. Taking LSD was a profound experience, one of the most important things in my life. LSD shows you that there's another side to the coin, and you can't remember it when it wears off, but you know it. It reinforced my sense of what was important, creating great things instead of making money, putting things back into the stream of history and of human consciousness as much as I could. So you may, you know, whoever you look up to as your heroes, your cultural icons, Steve Jobs is a cultural icon. And we can get into discussing, you know, the downside of Apple in their relationship with Foxconn and having to build suicide nets because the people are jumping out of the windows rather than continue working at the factories. So there's some systemic problems with Apple and their supply chain, to be clear and fair, okay? And so you can think of however you want of Steve Jobs, but and he had a reputation of being quite a prick. But he also understood that these substances have value, you know, and anything that allows you to think differently, as the Apple slogan goes on to say, anything that allows you to think differently is a good thing. There's too much groupthink out there. There's too many people just parroting what they see on the nightly news. So think differently. Yeah, I don't know that Steve Jobs would have approved that ad campaign through Chiat Day, his ad agency at the time, if he hadn't had his own experiences with psychedelics, because I think that made, I think that think differently mantra was probably something that Steve Jobs actually honestly believed in. And I think he came to that in part because of his experience with psychedelics. You know, it has an impact on people that is undeniable and never goes away. And if you look into a lot of the studies, you'll find that people Will, when asked, older people, especially when asked some of their most important events that happened to them in their lifetime, a lot of people will say their experience with psychedelic drugs, having been one of the, it'll be like the birth of my child, you know, my wedding, and like the first time I did mushrooms, you know? And I it's on my list. It's for sure. It's on my list. Some trips more memorable than others, of course, but that first time you do it, you go, oh my God, I'm such an idiot. I here I am thinking I knew how it all works in the world, and I know nothing. So it's humbling in that sense that it knocks you down a few pegs. Back to Terrence. And I think most people know about, you know, DMT through, you know, through Joe Rogan talking about it. And, but nobody, you know, really sort of personified DMT, pre-Rogan than, Terrence McKenna. And this is one of the things he said about it. I'm going to read a series of quotes from him because, let's face it, he's just way more interesting than I'll ever be. He said, DMT is a reliable method for crossing into a dimension that human beings have debated the existence of for 50,000 years. Is there an invisible nearby world inhabited by active intelligences with which human beings can communicate? You bet. And if you don't think so, then tell me you don't think so after you've smoked 75 milligrams of DMT. Otherwise, we just don't have anything to talk about. So, a little science lesson on DMT from a non-scientist, full disclosure. It is a psychedelic compound that is found naturally in the human body, as well as almost 100 different species of plants throughout the world. In fact, it's found in a lot of things. It is, without a doubt, the most powerful hallucinogen known to man. And oddly, the most common as well. And technically, we are all guilty of possession of a Schedule I substance because we are all holding DMT. So humans produce DMT in their pineal gland, which is a very small gland found in the middle of your brain, right behind our eyes. It's known to our ancestors and throughout history as the third eye. You've heard of the third eye. It is suggested that our brains are flooded with DMT during birth and death, sort of like a lubricant for the soul to enter and leave this world. It's suggested that. It's not necessarily proven that, but it is strongly suggested that. You can smoke it. You can consume it in a liquid version called ayahuasca. Ayahuasca is comprised, has DMT in it. It's different. So if you smoking it, the effects wear off in like 15 minutes. It's not a party drug. This is not like, you know, if you're a parent and you're worried about, oh, I hope my kids don't get into DMT. It's not like that. This isn't like a high. It's just like you just excuse yourself from this universe and you go to another universe for 15 minutes and then you come back into your body. I mean, it could be a party drug in a sense that if you had a couple people around and you did it, you would all be having this interesting experience going on and maybe you would call that a party. But it's not like you're going to duck into some bathroom and like, oh, I'm going to quick smoke some DMT and then go back out into the party. It's like you're incapacitated. You are like down on your back, laying down, experiencing this. It's not, and it wears off normally. And the reason why it wears off quickly and the reason why it does that is because, your body is really good at processing DMT because you have it and it processes it all the time. It is believed to be a component of your dreams, where you know that feeling when you wake up in the morning and you had a dream and you're trying to explain it to someone and it's like a fish slipping through your hands and you know you look kind of ridiculous trying to explain it all, as you know, like you would look if you're trying to catch a fish with your bare hands. You know, you're like, and then I went to this place and then we were doing it, and you're like, what was it? I don't even remember. You know, it sort of fades off. Like it has a self-erasing mechanism to it. You know, like this thought will explode in 10 seconds. You know, you get a couple seconds to like process and remember it, and then it kind of slips through your hands. It's very dreamlike in that sense. And everybody, you know, has different experiences with it. I haven't had the experience where I've seen machine elves or interacted with higher dimensional beings, but a lot of people have. In fact, one of my favorite quotes from my book was this one from Joe Rogan. DMT is mushrooms times a million plus aliens. So great. I think if people want to get a sense of DMT, and they've maybe, you know, you've listened to Rogan, he's talked about it a lot. There's a documentary called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. In fact, Joe is the host of that. He does a lot of the voiceover. He appears in it as well as the narrator talking about it. And here's a little excerpt from that movie, where a guy named Patricio Dominguez, who is a shaman and one of the DMT volunteers, is explaining his trip. And the way they did it in the movie was they were given it intravenously. So they were in a facility, I think it's in New Mexico. And this was through Rick Strassman, who was running the program. And they got the approval to do a scientific test. So they had these DMT volunteers come in and they would inject them with DMT. And then they would have them explain their situation, explain their trip afterwards, and be very detail oriented. And it happened in a medical setting and everything. They had nurses around. And so this was Patricio's description of one of his trips. He said, "So Laura removes the eye shades and I ask, not really with my eyes open quite yet, I ask, how long was I gone? Because I need to know." And Rick Strassman chimes in, 15 minutes. For a moment, I'm shocked. The mind has to try to catch up because now the whole cognitive dissonance of the experience has to catch up. I was gone for 15 minutes? 1,000 years of experience in 15 minutes? Well, to say the least, it was profound. It was profound. So it takes you someplace. You know, it takes you to a place that is it's hard to define. But Terence tries to define it. And this is where the name of the chapter comes in. So I'm going to read this. It's a couple. So this is just his explanation to it. What happens on DMT is a troop of elves smashes down your front door and rotates and balances the wheels of the after-death vehicle, presents you with the bill, then depart. It's completely paradigm-shattering. I mean, union with the white light you could handle. An invasion of your apartment by jeweled, self-dribbling basketballs from hyperspace that are speaking in demonic Greek is not something you anticipated and could handle. Sometimes people say, "Is DMT dangerous? It sounds so crazy." The answer is, only if you fear death by astonishment. It's interesting to try and to hear people's descriptions of these things. It's like trying to describe a dream, trying to describe something that's indescribable. One of the DMT volunteers in the movie The Spirit Molecule was a lady named Susan Blumenthal, and I mean, by all accounts, she looks like she worked at a library. You know, just a normal lady. And her description of it goes like this: "There was no concept of time. It was so disorienting. I was so terrified. I have never in my entire life been so terrified to be blasted out of my body, to leave my body behind, to be going at warp speed, backward, through my own DNA, out the other end, and into the universe. Suddenly, I was in this huge void with these beings on the other side. And I put out my hand, and this incredible rainbow of pink light went between me and these entities. And I was trying to make it be a white light, but it was this incredible pink light, this energy of love, this capacity of love that we as human beings have that I was trying to send to them. I looked around at my environment, and I was trying to absorb everything to understand. But there were all these machines or structures or things that I had never seen before, and I had no idea what they were. I was like a caveman in a computer lab. I didn't have any idea, but I knew in my intellectual awareness that this was a very advanced civilization or life forms or whatever they were, and they were far advanced from what we know here on Earth. It was all very impersonal until I got to the space where I realized that I was in the area where souls are awaiting rebirth. And I was there, and I had been there so many times before. I recognized it, and this incredible transcendent peace came over me. I have never in my life ever felt such peace. So Pete, this is one of the reasons why people think that DMT is involved in near-death experiences. That when your body thinks it's going to die, it floods the system with DMT. And people talk about going to the, you know, white lights and feeling this amazing sense of peace and things like that. You know, and this is, these are part of the stories. And one of my favorite ways that I've heard it described is, once again, Terrence McKenna. It always struck me as funny when he said this. He said this in one of his many lectures that I was listening to, and I put it in the book. He said, DMT raises all the questions in a hurry. It's so intense and so oriented toward the other and the visual and the hallucinogenic that it isn't really like a drug. It's more like an event that you ran into. You just came around a corner and there was the unspeakable. Man, I mean, that is that's an interesting way to describe it. You know, it's you do kind of come around the corner and there is the unspeakable. And if you're a fan of Graham Hancock like I am, you know, Fingerprints of the Gods is an amazing book he put out in 1995. And I had a chance to meet him actually when he was in Denver a couple months ago. He was on a book tour and we chatted for a little bit. I gave him this book because I'm like, you know, I think I quoted you in here like 7 or 8 different times. And one of them is having to do with psychedelics. He said, I think it's obvious that the psychedelics are demonized and illegalized by our society because somewhere in our society are controlling minds that realize that these substances have the potential, have the power to unpick the controlling hierarchy. And that's, of course, is true. And what's funny is that once you kind of open yourself up to these ideas, you start to realize that there's a lot of culture around us that is talking about these things. And they do it in their songs and writings and movies and you know, you'll catch it from time to time. You'll be like, wow, that's interesting that I didn't know this guy would be writing about it. I put the lyrics from a Paul Simon song in there. You know, you think Paul Simon, oh, Simon and Garfunkel, you know, this little guy and he's playing these rock songs or anything. Well, in his Rhythm of the Saints album that he put out in 1989, he had recorded Graceland in 86 in or 85, I guess, in Africa, in South Africa, with all these African bands. But then when he did his next album, he went to South America and recorded it there. And he had, you know, spent some time in the jungle before he wrote that album. If you listen to that album now, there's a lot of references to some, you know, there's flat out references to ayahuasca in there. In this song, Spirit Voices, he said, The song lyrics are, some stories are magical, meant to be sung, sung songs from the mouth of the river. When the world was young, all these spirit voices rule the night. My hands are numb. My feet were lead. I drank a cup of herbal brew. The sweetness in the air combined with the lightness in my head. And I heard the jungle breathing in the bamboo. So he's talking about his experiences with drinking ayahuasca in the jungles. And what's interesting about that, and you just, I mean, the way they make ayahuasca is it's brewed from a vine mixed with shrub leaves that contain DMT, and then they mix them together. And so there's, and one of them has an MAOI inhibitor, and it if you just drink something with DMT in it, your stomach acid will kill it all. But if you drink it mixed in with an MAOI, then it, what it does is it diffuses what's happening in your stomach. So it allows your body to process the DMT, which is why ayahuasca works. So what they had to do is they take one vine and one plant and combine them together and brew them for like 3 days in a certain process. And then it creates this sludge, which is unbelievably horrible to drink. And the problem is, or the sort of the math behind this is that there are 152,000 different species of plants in the Amazon region, but these guys figured out how to take one root vine and one plant and mix them together and brew them in a certain way that creates this sludge that you would never in a million years think to actually drink. But when you do drink it, it transports your soul to the edge of reality. And frankly, across the edge of reality, to be fair, and then takes you back home a couple hours later. And so with all these different types of plants, and the chances of figuring out this particular combination is practically impossible. When people have asked these shamans, how did you guys figure out how to do this? Their answer was, the jungle told us, which sounds crazy to you in your sober mind. But I'll tell you what, when I was, you know, 3 hours into an ayahuasca trip, I remember thinking about that, about them saying, you know, the jungle told us. And I, in that frame of mind, my feeling on that was, well, that makes sense, you know? I mean, it sounds crazy when you're totally sober, but at that point, yeah, okay, I get it. And the healing powers that come from ayahuasca, you know, it's just amazing. It's just amazing that, you know, that somebody figured out how to put these substances together and you know, in a way, in a combination that actually makes it work. And it's mathematically impossible to figure that out. And yet somehow they did it, and it's important. And these things have been carried on for years and years. Graham Hancock said, we live in a society that will send us to prison if we make use of time-honored sacred plants to explore our own consciousness. Yet surely the exploration and expansion of the miracle of our consciousness is the essence of what it is to be human. By demonstrating and persecuting whole areas of consciousness, we may be denying ourselves the next vital step in our own evolution. This is from his TED talk that he gave, a banned TED talk called The War on Consciousness, which he did in, you know, he did a TED talk and talked about these things. And then the TED organizers banned the speech, which, by the way, if you ever want to know how to turbocharge somebody's TED talk, just ban it, because it gets shared anyway. People make copies of it and it gets out there, and it's been watched, I don't know, 7 or 8 million times now, Graham Hancock's talk. So it backfired on them. So why would the TED people want to ban that video? I think they banned 3 videos total out of all their TED talks. Why would you invite Graham Hancock in to give a speech called The War on Consciousness and then ban it? I mean, I think the answer is that the powers that be don't want you to explore your own consciousness, because by doing so, like Terrence McKenna said, you know, it will expose, or as Graham said, it has the power to unpick the controlling hierarchy, you know, or as Graham Hancock says, it opens you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong. They don't want you thinking about that. They want you believing what they tell you is the truth. They want you listening to their laws and behaving in the way they want you to behave. You know, it's part of a control structure. And psychedelics help you to move away from that control structure. Terrence McKenna said, remember the scene in The Wizard of Oz when the curtain is swept back and they see the little guy there and he says, booming out over the loudspeaker, ignore the man pulling the levers. Well, the little man pulling the levers is what sweeps into view with psychedelics, and you discover, culture is provisional. Whether we have 9 wives or 3, whether we tattoo ourselves blue, whether we eat insects or not, all of these things are just decisions that we made. Then we congratulate ourselves on our wisdom, and we live within that, and we hunt down and kill all the people that disagree with us. That's called having a culture, a way of life. So yeah, that's what it's all about. It's about control. It's about controlling acceptable versions of reality. It's about keeping everybody on the reservation and not allowing people to get outside of that and see what's really going on. I am, you know, I've had phenomenal experiences with hallucinogenic substances, but I want to, you know, reiterate it. It's not a party, you know, you pay a price for it. I mean, if God, with ayahuasca, I'm not even kidding, you pay a physical price just throwing up constantly, you know, the purge and everything, but there's also symbolic gesture of that too, that you are getting rid of the things that are stuck inside of you in a physical sense with throwing up, and also in a metaphoric sense with, you know, releasing yourself from these, you know, self-imposed prisons that you put yourself in, or dealing with trauma and processing guilt and trying to figure out your place and where it allows you to see yourself in a much more honest fashion, as opposed to the, you know, trying to see through the layers and the walls we build up to protect ourselves, or that our ego uses to try and protect us from getting hurt, and all of these barriers that come up to save us from seeing ourselves. Ironic that I would put newspapers up over the mirrors in the bathrooms so I wouldn't see myself. But sometimes that examination is a little too much. You know, it's a little much. And I think, you know, for people that are interested in partaking in some of these activities, you know, you can do that in foreign countries. You could do it at an Acapulco, which is a conference that I've spoken at a couple, you know, the last 2 years. They have a la carte items that you can add on to your experience as a, you know, in addition to your ticket for the daily events and watching the speakers. You can add on the DMT ceremonies. You can add on Blue Deer Peyote ceremony. You can add on the Tiger ceremony, which is ayahuasca. And I've done all 3 of them there. And, you go through with like legit shamans that are from the jungle, and they have it set up, you know, in a way that is consistent with their religious ceremonies. It's not religion, but it's ceremonial for sure. And you can experience these things with, you know, in a group setting that will, I'll tell you what, man, it'll change your life. It'll change the way you see things. It'll change the way you see yourself and maybe the relationships that you have. I think these are good things. I would you know, I'm not a, you know, full disclosure, I'm not a doctor. Once again, I'm not, you know, I think if you have psychological problems, you might want to be careful with some of these things because, or at least just acknowledge that there is, you know, it's not all fun and games. You know, you sometimes have to get down to some serious business. During the first time I did the DMT ceremony, the lady next to me just was sobbing uncontrollably. Like it was so loud and went on for so long that it was really distracting. Actually, I mean, I felt bad for her. She was obviously working out some issues, but that can happen. You know, you can get emotional about things and, but I feel like you come out a better person on the other side and because you're trying to fix yourself or you're trying to see what else is out there. There's nothing wrong with that. Don't let your government try and scare you. Graham Hancock said it right. You know, the right to explore your own consciousness is the most human thing that we have. And to have some tyrannical government tell you what you can and can't do with your own body is fucking preposterous. It's just control. It's just control. It's a control structure by people that fear you having power. They don't want anyone else to have the power. And psychedelics open you up to the realization that nobody's really in control. You think you're in control of this world? You have the illusion of control. You know, there are things at work that we can't predict and we can't stop. And I think that I've been saying it since the first time I did mushrooms in the fall of 1990 when I went to school. When I went to college, I have been telling anybody that I'm close to that I found those experiences to be some of the most beneficial things I've ever done in my life. And I like to think I've done a lot of things in my life, but I'll never forget that. And so when I wrote this book, The Octopus of Global Control, and it came down to the editing process where we're taking things out of the book, the suggestion to take the psychedelic component out as a way to shorten the book, I couldn't do. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't take it out because I find it to be so important as a factor in this control structure that they're trying to keep you from that. They're trying to keep you from these substances because they know that they have the ability to change the world. And the people that are in control of this world don't want it changed. They want it to function the way it currently functions. They don't mind if you get hooked on heroin or, you know, do cocaine. I mean, they'll make it illegal and everything, but they don't really mind that because those are self-destructive substances. But anything that works to build you up and improve the way you see things, give you a different perspective and open you up to the possibility that the government you're living under is totally corrupt and full of shit and that their laws are arbitrary and meaningless in the universe, boy, they just cannot have that. And so anything that the government is actively trying to suppress is something that I'm probably going to be into, at least examining. So that's my take on psychedelics. It won't be my last, I'll be honest with you. I'll revisit this this topic later because there's so many layers to it. And maybe I'll try to get somebody on. I'd love to get one of the shaman guys that I've met with on multiple occasions to explain how it all works. At least, you know, how we think it all works. If you enjoyed this episode, you know, on all these podcasts, you get the ability to share it. You can share it on social media. It takes like 2 seconds to do that. I certainly appreciate it. We want to get the word out there and get as many subscribers as we can, because the more people that are hearing these interesting and unusual topics, the better chances that they'll then take them and start to think about them, and maybe we can wind up changing the world. So I appreciate it. I appreciate you guys listening. Thanks so much. Talk to you soon.